call the answer line, where you're the head honcho, the big cheese, top dog, big man, mighty boss. And you can tell us exactly where to go.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Radio Netherlands, not national, but international, broadcasting direct from Northwest Europe. Media Network, the weekly communications magazine with Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Ah, there you are. Hello. And the second part of our documentary series on Indonesia is scheduled later on in the programme. But we start with a bit of what could be very good news. The world of solar astronomy is divided as to whether three sunspot regions from the next solar cycle have been observed or not.
You don't need me to tell you that propagation via the higher shortwave bands is poor at the moment. This is caused by the 11-year solar cycle, which is coming to a close, or to a solar minimum as it's known. Between 1988 and 1992, solar activity and the sunspot number were high. During this period, the sun's output of ultraviolet illumination also increased, which in turn strengthened the ionosphere, allowing it to propagate shortwave frequencies up to and beyond 30 megahertz.
That was back then. Since 1992, this solar cycle, number 22, has declined. Currently, we're heading for the minimum period. Solar cycles, though, don't just finish and start anew. There's an overlap period of 1 or 2 years when sunspots are visible from both the old and the emerging cycle. Dr. John Kennewell is principal physicist at the joint IPS, United States Air Force Solar Observatory at Learmonth in Western Australia. We asked him how he's sure the new one's on its way.
We're not absolutely sure, and sunspot cycles are normally measured from what we call the minimum of the sunspot number curve. Now, we certainly haven't reached that minimum yet, but we have evidence that we might be closing in upon it, probably toward the latter part of next year. That evidence comes from new sunspot groups that we have evidence that points to their belonging to this new cycle 23.
How can you tell the difference? I mean, sunspots are sunspots, aren't they? They're black spots on the disk of the sun.
Not quite. And the evidence is both geometrical and lies in the magnetic field, which is associated with sunspots. Basically, each sunspot group is what we call a bipolar magnetic group. That is, at one end of the sunspot group, we have, say, a north polarity, and the other end, we have a south polarity. Now, we have a very interesting phenomenon on the sun that during one cycle, all the sunspot groups belonging to that cycle have the westward, or what we call the leading spot of the group, of one particular magnetic polarity. Now, for cycle 22 that we have at the moment, in the northern hemisphere, the leading sunspot group, that is, the group towards the west of the sun, always has a south, or what we call negative, magnetic polarity. And the trailing spot in the group has a north magnetic polarity. Now, what happens in the southern hemisphere is quite the reverse. The leading spot in the group has a north polarity, and the trailing spot has a south polarity. Now, even more interesting than that, when we come to the next cycle, that reverses. And so the sunspot groups that had the southern hemisphere polarity now take on what used to be the northern hemisphere magnetic polarity. And that is one way that we can distinguish between sunspot groups of one cycle and the next. The sun ain't gonna shine anymore. Moon ain't gonna rise in the sky. Tears are always clouding your eyes. Sun ain't.
There are other factors too. At the start of the sunspot cycle, sunspots tend to appear at latitudes of 25 to 40 degrees from the sun's equator. Sunspot regions from the old cycle, though, appear closer to the equator. On the 13th of May of this year, the first of the regions appeared briefly at 13 degrees north. The second sunspot region was observed on the 26th of July at 18 degrees south, and the third was visible on the 13th of August at 20 degrees south. Much discussion is taking place as to whether these sunspot regions are really from the new cycle. Their low latitudes have broken the rule book.
Although these all had the correct magnetic polarity for cycle 23, they have all been rather lower latitude than they would expect. Now, it is not uncommon for a region to get what we call a little lost and stray into the wrong hemisphere. And so a lot of people at the moment are saying that, in fact, these groups that we've been observing may, in fact, not be cycle 23, but may be cycle 22. But the fact that they have the right geometric orientation, that is, the leader, the westerly most part of the group, is inclined toward the equator, would tend to indicate to me that they are probably cycle 23 rather than cycle 22.
Is it important? I mean, you say that there's a discussion in the scientific community where Boulder says, no, it's just 22 and there's something wrong with the spots, whereas you're saying, no, there's plenty of evidence to point to 23. Does it really matter?
I think people who are shortwave listeners will find it very important, because the major significance of finding new cycle spots lies in their predictive value for solar minimum. And of course, we're all interested in solar minimum, because after solar minimum, the sunspot number will rise, the 10-centimeter flux will rise, and the FOF2 of the ionosphere, the critical frequencies that support shortwave radio broadcasting, will rise, and thus shortwave broadcasters will have access to a much wider range of frequencies than they do at the moment. Now, the predictive value is such that when we find the first spot group of a new cycle, we can say that minimum will be somewhere between about 12 and 20 months away. And this would mean that if, in fact, these are the May, July, and August spot groups are cycle 23, we would then expect the solar minimum to occur between June and December next year, 1996. And this would give us a duration of cycle 22 somewhere between 9.7 and 10.3 years. This is a little bit shorter than the average that we normally quote for a sunspot cycle of 11 years, but there is other evidence that leads us to believe that cycle 22 has every reason to be a little bit shorter than the average sunspot cycle.
Dr. John Kennywell.
And we stay in Australia. There's another broadcaster we can officially welcome to the World Wide Web. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation has a site with more than 1,000 hyperlinked files available, and that's just a start. The external broadcaster, Radio Australia, is also part of the internet presentation.
The ABC and Radio Australia discontinued the transcription service a little while back. Now the audio files of complete programmes will be posted on the internet very shortly, so they say. What do you think the pages look like?
Well, I think the pages look very nice. It's fine design, good overview of programme and frequency information. For the moment, only available in English, but Indonesian, Tok Pisin and French are coming soon. And if you want to check the ABC pages, the URL address is http://www.abc.net.au. And if this was going too fast, you don't have a pen at hand, you can find a link to Radio Australia's worldwide web pages via the Radio Netherlands English pages from tomorrow onwards.
Now to Asia, where the BBC reports that frequencies of its Burmese service are suddenly being jammed with a warbling noise. The exact location of the jamming site is yet to be determined. In the meantime, extra shortwave channels have been added. And now this.
Then and now, a two-part profile on broadcasting in Indonesia. Part 2, how independent is radio today?
The power struggle during the months immediately after the Second World War is still being discussed in the Netherlands and Indonesia today. More so in the Netherlands, as Queen Beatrix is currently on an official visit to the former Dutch colony. Having lost so much during the war in Europe, many Dutch resisted the idea that Indonesia would ever leave the kingdom. Sadly, the negotiations towards a settlement dragged on. What looked like a peaceful transfer of power, in whatever form, started to turn sour in 1947. But there were still some lighter moments. Willem van den Berg worked for the Dutch colonial government radio in Batavia, now Jakarta.
And I remember very well that one day, when Princess Juliana was still princess and not Queen Juliana, as she became in 1948, was in 1947, then the wife of the Lieutenant Governor General, Mrs. van Mook, wanted to congratulate Princess Juliana with her birthday. So she had to come to our studio at the Koningsplein in Batavia. But we had no studio available then at that time. So I went to my Indonesian colleague, Mr. Yusuf, and said, can you lend me a studio for Mrs. van Mook? And he said, for Mrs. van Mook? I said, yes, she is coming to congratulate Princess Juliana, and can you help me? And he said, of course. And then Mrs. van Mook, the wife of the highest representative of the Netherlands government, then went into the studio of Radio Republican Radio Indonesia, confronted by all pictures of Sukarno and Hatta, and there she congratulated Princess Juliana.
The move towards independent radio in those days has parallels with Indonesian radio today. In the middle of the chaos surrounding the night of September 30th, 1965, students set up Radio Ambra, which ran from October 65 until March of the following year.
Pukul 19, waktu Indonesia Barat. Inilah Radio Arma 11, Yogyakarta.
Towards the end of the 60s, the station was given a license, partly because it backed the government's crackdown against the communists. As you just heard, Radio Ambra, the student station in Yogyakarta, is still on medium wave 1188 kHz. Licenses for other stations were issued shortly after, but with a lot of restrictions. Zainar Suryokusumo is the vice chairman of the Federation of Indonesian Private Radio Stations.
Because Indonesia have many cities. Every city have their own radio station. For instance, like Jakarta. In Jakarta only, we have 38 radio stations. In Yogyakarta, 15 radio stations. So, for the all population, 647 private radio stations compared to the population in Indonesia is not quite enough.
A quarter of the time on the radio can be sold for commercials. Just under half consists of entertainment, usually music. And 25% of the airtime is reserved for government information, often in the form of an off-air relay of RRI news from Jakarta or a regional government station.
Although shortwave is still important to the government to reach outlying areas and for the overseas service, advertisers on the commercial stations are interested mainly in FM. Of the 38 stations in the capital Jakarta, only 8 are on medium wave. But what about the power?
It's funny too, because the regulation set for FM is only up to 100 watts output power, and for the AM station it's up to 250 watt output power. But in reality, FM radio station in Jakarta is at least they are operate up to 5 kilos. It's around 5,000 watts output power. There is a radio station using more than that, double that that output power.
As far as technical standards are concerned, the government apparently turns a blind eye.
Production values vary too. Some stations sound very laid back. Others concentrate on packaging their promos, like Western stations. Take this example from Yogyakarta.
Grand opening, Mixed Club Music Room, Jogja International Hotel. Yes, hadir di Yogyakarta Mix Club Music Room 29 Mei 95 jam 22 sampai dengan selesai bersama guest star DJ Max Don from Ebony Fidetic Jakarta.
Stations in major cities like Jakarta are worth $1.5 million, whereas if you wanted to buy a station in the middle of Borneo, $15,000 would be nearer the price.
Joe Coleman is the head of Radio Netherlands Indonesian service and watches the domestic media in that country closely. I put it to him that 640 private stations doesn't sound a lot when you realise that the total population of Indonesia was estimated at 200,409,000 in July of 1994.
No, and I think you've got to be careful with your definition of commercial stations. A lot of those in the 600-odd are sort of private stations. Not many of them are very commercial. There are an increasing number of reasonably successful commercial stations, but what they're doing in advance of what they expect to be an open skies policy similar to television, commercial television just took off as soon as the restrictions were removed, and they're hoping for that sometime this year. The Minister for Information has promised that new laws looking after radio will be legislated soon. But the clever people amongst those people who've already got a reasonably established network, say in Jakarta or in larger cities like Surabaya, for example, have already started up buying the licenses, if you like, of those small stations. They've just taken over the small stations and are keeping them on air in their present form. And I suspect that once the legislation is there, that those people will have a ready-made network. They can centralise their advertising activities in Jakarta, and that will then open up the possibility for commercial development. It's certainly money media.
You're saying that these licences are changing hands now for money, which is strange, bearing in mind that the licences were originally free. But are they scarce?
Yes, they're very scarce, because those people who were lucky enough to get licences in the days when it was easy enough to get a licence because it was private and not so commercial, those actual licences are worth value. It's just like buying a licence to have a fishing boat. Eventually, economic progress will put the cost of that up, provided you've still got something to sell.
But there are restrictions. I mean, you can't put out your own news.
The commercial stations themselves, or the private and commercial stations organisation, the Federation of Commercial and Private Broadcasters, for example, are hoping that these restraints will be lifted. They have been lifted to a certain extent in television, and they're hoping that the radio law will be a parallel to that. And that will then build in the element of self-censorship that we see in television.
But surely it depends on your definition of news. You can't broadcast news bulletins, but you can put out news maybe in the form of a talk show, a discussion programme.
Exactly. The news bulletins are, by law, restricted to the broadcast of Radio Republic Indonesia. If you have a station, you're on air at the time that Radio Republic Indonesia goes to air, then you must relay that news bulletin. But after that, a lot of stations have tried to get around this problem of what's news and what's not by looking at the grey area of what is topical, for example, in their own areas. And they do have problems sometimes when controversial subjects come up in those talk shows. And of course, once you open the line, despite the fact that you've got a delay system or you can filter that, some of the more adventurous producers of those programs have been in trouble with the government because they've allowed things to develop too much. And through the normal pressures that exist in government circles and on radio and media, then pressure has been brought to bear. And one of the most popular talk shows, for example, in Jakarta, which was Jakarta Morning Program or whatever, Jakarta Today, was pulled off the air because they decided to change the format, they said.
And finally, what's the most important media at the moment? Is it becoming television?
It certainly is for those people that have got television. There's some sort of a myth built up in Indonesia at the moment that television is accessible to everybody. It is not, because of economic circumstances in a lot of areas. Television may be 24 hours in the major cities, but it certainly isn't in the outlying areas. TVRI, for example, a national government-owned television network, is not available to all people in all areas. And in some villages, for example, as close as Bali, which is not very far away from the centre in Jakarta, you'll find one old television sitting up in a local district hall with about three people watching that, while all the others are still down watching their Balinese dances. And I like that.
Katarina Panji is Communications Officer for the Worldwide Fund for Nature in Indonesia. It's the first non-governmental organization to recognize the power of radio and actively use the independent stations as an outlet for their environmental information.
About 2 years ago, WWF Indonesia started a kind of script service program. It was done after we identified that radio is a kind of forgotten media in Indonesia in terms of awareness program for environmental or conservation issues. And also at the other side, there are more than 500 radio stations, private radio stations in Indonesia, plus more than 200 state radio stations, which are providing a lot of outlets for disseminations of environmental issues.
But one of the most effective ways to get information across is getting involved in the talk show business.
Besides script service, we also have a special radio program, which is talk show. We have cooperations with one of radio stations in Jakarta to have a weekly talk show on women and environment. So we invite the experts for the interview. We also have phone calls. We also commission a local NGO in Bogor to do the talk show program on environmental issues as well. And also two of our projects in Sumatra has a special radio program in Kerinci Seblat and in Gunung Loser. Kerinci Seblat is in Jambi and Gunung Loser is in Aceh. So I guess that we have a lot of chance to expand our program, and we are looking forward to work with probably with Radio Netherlands and other agencies.
At the moment, WWF Indonesia gets financial backing from the Worldwide Fund for Nature office in the Netherlands. They also get some pre-produced television material, although funds do not yet allow for the awareness campaigns to be styled for the Indonesian market. Some would say they look too Western.
I have to say also that TV industry in Indonesia is growing very fast for the last 3 or 4 years, and also as well as radio stations, TV stations also provide us a lot of outlets for environmental program. But the problem is funding.
Funding's a problem facing radio too, and it's more the economic constraints of the marketplace that regulate the system rather than the available frequencies.
My friends in the radio station says that in some cities it's more already like saturated. That's why like in Jakarta, the government will not give any new license for the radio stations. But for the small cities outside Java especially, there's still market.
Katarina Panji of the Worldwide Fund for Nature in Indonesia, ending that two-part feature on broadcasting in Indonesia. Research and interviews by Marijke van der Meer.
Media Network Book Review.
Earlier this year, on the other side of the North Sea, BBC Television broadcast a two-part documentary about the corporation's activities during the Second World War. The program was called What Did You Do in the War, Auntie? And a book of the same name has also been published. Written by Tom Hickman, this 224-page hardback contains many of the stories and quotes seen on the television program, but much more besides. The auntie in the title is the BBC itself. This nickname was used throughout the war and for many years after it ended. But, as Tom Hickman explains, it wasn't always meant kindly.
The radio did not inform. It hectored, and like a spinster aunt, it fussed. The BBC had never been called auntie before the war, despite the number of aunties who, with rather more uncles, kept children occupied on its national and regional networks. Now, the sobriquet began to enter the language, and it was not born of the affection it later engendered.
The problem was that, in the first months of the war, the BBC's programme diet seemed to consist of interminable talks interspersed with interminable broadcasts by Sandy McPherson playing the theatre organ. And initially, the corporation didn't seem to realise that this wasn't what the people wanted.
The BBC was foolishly congratulating itself, in the first emergency issue of Radio Times, on the splendid service it would continue to provide in wartime. This, during a fortnight when the country's nerve ends were being rubbed raw by 45-minute sessions of Sandy McPherson.
Soon, however, things took a turn for the better, and the various BBC programme departments, which had been moved out of London to other parts of the country, began to function again. By far the most important of these was Variety, which was to provide a huge amount of morale-boosting entertainment for the next 6 years. As Hickman says, the BBC was getting into its stride.
The public had forgiven the BBC for the shambles of the early days of war. It liked the new hours of broadcasting. The old national and regional programmes had opened at a leisurely 10:15 a.m. The Forces programme was on parade at 6:30 a.m. and the Home Service hitting the ground running half an hour later.
Meanwhile, the BBC's news journalists were learning to adapt to the war situation. And during the 6 years of the war, enormous progress was made in the style of news programmes and in the technical resources that made them possible. In 1939, news bulletins consisted of a dinner-jacketed announcer reading from a script in a studio. By the end of the war, personalities such as Richard Dimbleby had become famous for their on-the-spot reports from the front line. Listeners could hear the sounds of war behind the voices of the correspondents. But by present-day standards, the equipment they had to use was primitive and heavy to carry around. Recordings were made on acetate-covered aluminium discs, often under harsh conditions.
Dimbleby moved about the front. Once in the Jura Mountains, he recorded a march past of the band of the Chasseurs Alpins at 6 a.m. in a blinding snowstorm. From time to time, the mobile unit went to Reims, where fellow reporter Charles Gardner was with the advanced air striking force. In temperatures as low as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, frost patterns formed on the blank discs, and the engineer took them to bed so that he would be able to record on them in the morning.
The same technology was used back home, sometimes in unusual ways. In December 1941, the King made his usual Christmas broadcast, but nerves combined with a natural speech impediment resulted in a far from perfect performance. Churchill demanded that the speech be doctored before being repeated on the Empire service, so listeners around the world would hear a more confident-sounding monarch. The task was assigned to engineer David Martin.
Martin had two recordings to work from, the recording of the live broadcast and one made earlier in the day, which would have been patched in had the line from Sandringham been bombed. Each recording was on four 12-inch acetate discs, with only the outer 2 inches or so of each one having been used because that was where the best sound quality was. Martin set them up on a bank of 8 turntables, then identified the stutters and pauses, putting yellow marks with a grease pencil where one word finished and the next word began. There were sometimes 3 or 4 grooves between them. When the link-up began, he hopped the pickup from groove to groove. I did that for Africa, then for India, the 2 North Americas, East and West, the Pacific. There was no tape and no fancy editing devices in those days. It was all done by hand. The Pacific broadcast finished at 6:20 the following morning. I was knackered.
Broadcasts for overseas listeners came from Bush House, where the BBC's Empire service had moved in the spring of 1941. The importance of overseas broadcasting increased dramatically as the war progressed. Apart from the BBC's own output, the British government allowed exiled European governments and heads of state to broadcast to their own people over BBC transmitters. The French, Dutch, Poles and Yugoslavs made their own programmes, while Norway seconded some of its people to the BBC's Norwegian section. Things didn't always go smoothly.
Dennis Mayne Wilson also went into a studio where the Serbs and Slovenes fell out with the Croats over whose turn it was to broadcast. Communism versus fascism, and a punch-up which I had to sort out. It's sad how history repeats itself.
But there were lighter moments too. In the wartime atmosphere, everyone was equal, and people of many nationalities mixed freely in the corridors of Bush House. Some even slept there, including one member of staff who had a close encounter with the Queen of the Netherlands, when she accidentally trod on him as she walked down a darkened corridor to answer a call of nature. This is just one of hundreds of little anecdotes which Tom Hickman collected when he spoke to many of the people who worked at the BBC during the 6 years of the war. The result is a highly readable account, full of important facts, but never dull. The author takes a thematic rather than a chronological approach, and this works very well. He does provide a brief chronology at the end of the book for those who like to know exact dates.
Well, What You Do in the War, Auntie, is a book we can highly recommend. It's published by BBC Books and costs £15.99 in the UK. The ISBN number is 0563 371 2161. Thanks, Mike, and that's it for this time. From Diana Janssen and myself, have a pleasant weekend.
Media Network, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks and Diana Janssen for Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.